Welcome to today's presentation of the 2019 Legislative Update for Law Enforcement. This webinar is brought to you by the Utah Prosecution Council, the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training. I'm Christopher Fielding of Post Media Services, and I will be moderating today's webinar. We are also pleased to have with us today Tyson Skeen, Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor with the Utah Prosecution Council, and Marlise Jones, Sexual Assault Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor, also with the Utah Prosecution Council. We will now turn the time over to Tyson Skeen.
Thank you, Chris. We're happy to be here again this year doing this webinar for all the officers out there for the legislative update. As you well probably know, almost all of these bills went into effect on May 14th of this year. So as you're listening to this, these bills will already be in effect. There are a handful, well, maybe not even a handful, a few that have later implementation dates, and we will try to point those out as we go through. Otherwise, if you don't hear otherwise, these bills are already in effect and have the full force of law. So we're happy to be here to talk about these, and we'll dive right in.
Okay, so we're going to start out with a couple of victim bills, House Bill 15 and House Bill 281. These bills address first-degree felony cases. So if a victim of a first-degree felony crime or a family member of a missing persons or homicide case request a review, that can be made to the head of the police agency. So sheriff or chief or the head of police agency, this request can be made under this statute. The agency would then provide a review of it based on a couple criteria, or three criteria actually. First of all, they have to be the agency of jurisdiction. Second of all, 1 year has to have passed from the time of the initial report to allow for time to investigate. And then third, the case cannot yet have been screened by a county or district attorney. This is a lengthy bill that outlines notification and time limits. There is a progressive process in which review can be made by first the head of agency, then a victim can request that a review be made by the county and or district attorney, and then a request can be made to have the attorney general's office review it, which is what addresses House Bill 281, where it talks about just expanding and clarifying the attorney general's office powers to review these cases. Again, it would only be specific to first degree felony cases. And for their review, they would be looking at any failure to screen or a declination of a screening before doing a review. And they would also check back with the agency to make sure that their review would not interfere with any other strategic or investigative process.
House Bill 16 has to do with fraudulent drug testing. This is a new bill this year. It creates a new infraction for those who use, distribute, possess, or sell a synthetic urine or an adulterant to beat a drug test. Now, this is a bill that we wanted to put out there to make sure there was no misconceptions or anything in regards to where it applies. This does not apply to those people who are under court-ordered supervision or on parole or other things like that where they are ordered to do drug testing. There are much more severe consequences for those people, including violations of their probation or parole, but also potentially new criminal charges under the evidence tampering statute. This bill does not apply to those people and some others as well. This has a very narrow scope of where it is applicable. It creates a, like I said, it's an infraction only, so not our higher end of things here that we're dealing with, but it's only for those private employers who essentially are requiring a drug test as part of employment. And if the employee or potential employee uses some of these substances or tries to beat these drug tests with a synthetic urine or adulterant, or those who distribute or sell those are guilty of an infraction. I don't think we're going to see this very often, as private employers are most likely going to just not hire that person or fire that person for failing the drug test to move on. They're not going to be reporting those to law enforcement. But we've had some questions about this, so we want to make sure that there's not misconceptions. It did not reduce our ability to charge people on probation or parole or in other areas similar to that that are being court-ordered or have to take drug tests for other reasons. Those people are specifically excluded in this statute, and so it will not apply to them. We don't have to worry about any lesser-included offenses for those people or anything like that. It simply is a new opportunity in a very narrow scope for people trying to beat drug tests.
We've got three human trafficking of children and vulnerable adult and some other vulnerable adult amendment bills, starting with HB 20, then also Senate Bill 202 and HB 108. So beginning with HB 20, this bill does a few things. First of all, it removes human trafficking of children from statute of limitations. So that will now be a crime that no longer has a statute of limitations. It removes the mistake of age defense from this crime. It also creates a first-degree felony offense for anyone who benefits from or receives services through the commercial sex industry involving human trafficking of a child. In addition, it creates a new mandate or clarifies a mandate that any time law enforcement encounter a child involved in the sex industry, so any child under the age of 18, they will investigate that, shall, as the statute says, they shall investigate that as a human trafficking of a child case. The presumption is that any child up to the age of 18 is a victim and not a willing participant or player in the commercial sex industry. This bill also talks about vulnerable adults. It creates a first-degree felony, human trafficking of a vulnerable adult. Similar to the child trafficking statute, it does not require force, fraud, coercion in order to meet the elements of this crime. And it involves a burden shift for prosecution as far as prosecuting those cases. Moving on to Senate Bill 202. This talks more about vulnerable adults. First of all, it codifies probably a term that some of us have already been using for the adult population over the age of 18, but under the age of 65 that has other physical or mental impairments. And it now defines it by statute as a dependent adult. So we have elder adults who are 65 years of age or older. We now have dependent adults identified by statute. And the vulnerable adult label now incorporates both those populations. This bill also looked at the definition of caretaker, and it includes anyone with caretaking responsibilities, regardless of whether it was voluntarily assumed, ordered by a court, or whether or not they are being paid for their caretaking services. It creates a new crime for isolating a vulnerable adult. That's a third-degree felony. So it prohibits anyone from preventing a vulnerable adult from communicating, visiting, interacting, or initiating interaction with others. And it also creates a crime of personal dignity exploitation of a vulnerable adult. This would be a Class A for intentional or knowing conduct, or a Class B for reckless conduct. And this involves any caretaker who creates, transmits, or displays photos or videos of a vulnerable adult that show nudity or close-ups of private body parts that are demeaning or offensive, or show the vulnerable adult engaged in harmful or dangerous conduct. There's certainly folks out there that think it's funny to put vulnerable adults in these situations because it's bizarre to see, but it is not funny and it is now a crime. That leaves us with House Bill 108, which mirrors in many respects the previous House Bill 20, again reiterating the presumption that any child in connection with a commercial sex industry shall be treated as a victim, and the case will be investigated as a child trafficking case. But it also adds child trafficking to the list of crimes that we can file an enticement of a minor to as well. So that's helpful for prosecution.
House Bill 23 has to deal with gambling amendments. This is a bill that is specifically targeting the quarter machines and things like that that have started popping up in some of our gas stations and pawn shops and laundromats around the state. These have become very, very common, and while they were arguably still against the law under our old statute, there was some ambiguity when it came to those types of devices, whether they were a gambling device or not. This bill adds a fringe gambling definition to our gambling statute, which clearly now encompasses those devices, those gaming devices, quarter machines, different things like that. You may recall a big news story the day these bills went into effect. Down from Price, they went and seized a bunch of these quarter machines or these gambling devices from a laundromat / pawn shop down there, and were able to get that through. If you are seeing these, they're very common in gas stations, different things like that, where the owners of the gas station are told you can take a part of the take if you just allow us to put this here. Those are against the law, and you can go in, you can get a warrant and go in and seize those. and be able to refer those for prosecution to various people involved in those activities. But the ambiguity under our old law is now gone, and it is now very clear that these are fringe gambling devices and apply to our gambling statute.
But Chuck E. Cheese isn't in trouble, are they?
Chuck E. Cheese is not in trouble. There is an exception. If the game or device gives a novelty or toy with a value of less than $10, so we can still take our kid to Chuck E. Cheese's and not have to worry about being prosecuted for gambling. House Bill 40 and Senate Bill 43 we'll talk about together. These are kind of two large criminal bills that came out of a task force charged by the legislature to look at our criminal code and see maybe where we were off. I mean, we've all heard those funny news stories of, you know, a bill that's still on a city ordinance where you can't ride a horse on Tuesday between 3 and 4 o'clock. Well, luckily, we didn't have anything like that in there, but we did find some things that weren't being used and maybe weren't as applicable in today's world as they were when they were written. This bill amends, repeals several things. There's about two to three dozen bill or statute codes that were impacted by this. Many are things that aren't going to impact anything that we do in our day-to-day lives. Things like failing to return a marriage license reduced from a Class B to an infraction. Adultery, consensual sodomy, fornication are no longer criminal codes in Utah code. Those have been taken off. There are a few that are important, though, however, that you'll want to be aware of. The Clandestine Drug Lab Act now includes THC concentrates and counterfeit opioids. So if we have a case where people are doing extracting THC concentrates, we have some more teeth there. We also have the Electronic Communication Harassment Statute. So if you've been paying attention to that statute the last couple years, 2 years in a row we had intent language removed from that statute to the point where after last year's legislative session, it really basically was an unenforceable statute. It got to the point where there was nothing that we could really do on that. They had removed the intent to frighten or harass as part of that. This year they put frighten and harass back in. So that actually allows the Electronic Communication Harassment Statute to apply to harassing behavior. And so that was a good change. There's several other things in there. There are some important things. There are some things, like I said, that you won't care about. But take a look in there and see the different provisions of that bill. There are quite a few statute codes that were impacted. Very non-controversial things, though, where this task force made recommendations to the legislature to change.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about service animals. Previously, to make a false representation that your animal was a service animal was a Class B misdemeanor. This is now a Class C misdemeanor, so it's been lowered one degree. Not to diminish the importance or the severity as far as a public issue, but just to try and provide some uniformity, because they've also created another offense of false representation to a healthcare provider in order to get a service animal. That is also a Class C misdemeanor. We know that service animals are a much needed part of the medical care for some people. And unfortunately, that necessity has been abused by others who are purporting that their animals are service animals. And it does great harm to those that need service animals because they do not get the respect or the accommodations that they should be having. So this is an effort to try and step that up a little bit by creating a new crime for it. Victim Communications Amendments. So House Bill 53 and House Joint Resolution 3. What this deals with is victim advocates. There's been a lot of discussion in the last two legislative sessions about confidentiality provisions for victim advocates. And so here's the bottom line. For those of you that have advocates within your police departments or prosecution agencies, these are government or system-based advocates. Others may have advocates that are in community shelters or other resources in the community. Those are community-based advocates. Community-based advocates have confidentiality. They do not need to share any disclosure made to them by a victim in the process of receiving advocacy services, nor can they be put on the stand and direct or cross-examined as to any disclosure made. However, government or system-based advocates do not have that blanket immunity or confidentiality, I should say. Any disclosures made to them are considered to be part of the prosecution team information, as are your disclosures or your investigation knowledge. That's imputed to the prosecutor. So any government or system-based advocate that makes disclosures or that has a victim make disclosures to them will need to provide that information to their prosecutor. If a prosecutor determines that information should be passed on to defense counsel, a lot of it probably will not be an issue. However, some might have some concerns as far as victim safety, even though it's exculpatory or impeachable information. So there's an additional layer of screening put in place with the court where a judge can do a review of it and determine whether or not that needs to be shared with defense counsel. So if you have advocates in your areas, it's important that they be aware of these changes so that they can let victims know what to expect and whether or not their disclosures will need to be shared with prosecution.
House Bill 57 is dealing with electronic information and data privacy. It's always been clear, if you have suspected that there's illegal information on somebody's computer or a cell phone or anything like that, and you're not able to get consent to go and look at that, that you were going to need a warrant to go in and get into that computer or get into that cell phone. However, if I had illegal information on my cell phone that I sent to maybe a third-party storage system, Facebook, third-party cloud-based systems, different things like that, a very common practice was to use a judicially granted investigative subpoena to go and get that information. House Bill 57 changes that. This is a bill that basically codifies many Fourth Amendment principles in search and seizure into state statute and extends things beyond maybe what the Fourth Amendment has said that we need to do in regards to search and seizure with a warrant. We will now need a warrant to go get that information from those third-party cloud-based systems. There still are limited circumstances that you're able to use judicially granted investigative subpoenas, but the information that you can get is very limited. We're talking only like subscriber information. So you can get who the subscriber of the account is, potentially, but you wouldn't be able to get any of the actual evidence in the account. And so if you're already going to a judge to get that investigative subpoena, it's just a better idea to just get the warrant. Then you'll get the subscriber information and the legal information or evidence that you're looking for. Of course, there are always exceptions to search and seizure type rules. And this does talk about exigencies and different things like that. There still are opportunities to utilize warrantless searches, but you're going to need to be working very closely with your prosecutors if you're going to be doing that, because you're going to want to make sure that you're not illegally obtaining the information, not just under the Fourth Amendment now, but under this new law, because there are There is exclusion language in the statute that says that if you obtain it in violation of the statute, the evidence is excluded, just like it would have been if we violated the Fourth Amendment. So warrant is the best policy when it comes to this electronic information. It really was before anyways, and now it's mandated by statute. House Bill 62 is dealing with correctional and peace officer amendments. Prior to this change, if someone were to propel an object or a substance at somebody in a jail or one of our prisons, and that person was a peace officer or correctional officer, employee or volunteer, including healthcare providers that are in the jails and prisons providing healthcare to our inmates, and that person received substantial bodily injury. So that's this object or substance caused substantial bodily injury. That was previously a Class A misdemeanor. It has now been enhanced to a third degree felony.
Aggravated kidnapping, House Bill 82. Previously, we were able to enhance kidnapping and unlawful detention to a first-degree felony. That has now changed. So aggravated kidnapping can be an enhancement from kidnapping, and that remains a first-degree felony. However, unlawful detention can now be enhanced to an aggravated kidnapping, but is only a third-degree felony. So it's a lower-level enhancement. It's still entitled the same, aggravated kidnapping, but it would be only prosecuted as a third-degree felony.
House Bill 94, Weapons Restrictions Amendments. This is a bill that actually came in result to our .05 BAC bill a couple years ago. When that bill passed, it was discovered that this was going to impact carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence. So we've had that statute, but it does not tell us what under the influence is. But it does say that you're presumed to be under the influence of alcohol if you are above the level set in 41-6A-502, which is our DUI law. So when we reduced our per se BAC in our DUI law from 0.08 to 0.05, it reduced the presumptive level in carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence from 0.08 to 0.05. That was not an intended consequence of the 05 bill that was strictly designed to be a DUI bill. So they looked at it. They tried to figure out how they could figure out what unintended consequences were there and then how they could remedy those. The ultimate conclusion was that, is at least of the opinion of those who are making these decisions, is that if you're not safe to drive a car, then you're not safe to be walking around with a gun either and firing that gun. And so they did not do anything to change that presumptive language from 08 to 05. It still is just as it was. They did put some exceptions in, however. So this law now says that under these following circumstances, the person will be not guilty of carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence. So if the weapon is securely encased, all right, that's pretty self-explanatory. If it's securely encased in some sort of box or other case, that it will not be considered to be carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence. Or if it is not in such close proximity to be used as readily as if being carried on the person. That one's going to be a little bit more factually dependent. As you're doing investigations and these things come up, as prosecutors, we're probably going to need a little bit more information than you've given us in the past to be able to successfully prosecute these. What was the distance that the weapon was from the person? Were there any barriers in between them? Would they have had to walk around a chair to get to it, even if it was semi-close? Because those things are all going to be that it would not be as readily available as if being carried on the person. So we're going to need to know those things. So you'll want to give us a little bit more information, most likely, with these than we've been getting in the past. Another situation where a person will not be considered guilty of carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence is if that person was lawfully using the weapon in self-defense or defense of others. So if we come out to a situation, there's an investigation where somebody is deemed to have lawfully use self-defense, then we're not going to be able to charge them with carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence, even if they were under the influence. And then the last is, and it can be somewhat problematic, is this idea is if the person is carrying in their own residence or in the residence of another that has given them permission to do so. Now, this idea dates back to before we were even a country, the old common law idea of your house is your castle and we can do what we want in our castle so long as we're not infringing upon the rights of other people. And that idea makes sense. And we have the unfortunate knowledge in the law enforcement and prosecution world of knowing that guns and alcohol and homes don't always make for great parties when they're combined together. And this could be particularly troubling in some of our domestic violence cases. Again, this does not impact your ability to go out and investigate whatever crime it was that you were called out to the scene to investigate. It's generally never a standalone charge. This carrying a dangerous weapon under the influence is never what we're investigating. We're usually investigating some other criminal act, and then we tack this charge on because they happen to be a concealed weapons license holder who got a DUI or something else like that. It's not going to impact our ability to do any of the underlying offenses. It just means that if they fit one of these exceptions, securely encased or not in close enough proximity, lawful self-defense or defense of others, or carrying in their own residence or a residence where they have permission to do so, we won't tack that on. There's also some tricky language in this bill in regards to those who are exempt from weapons laws. I'm just going to put that on your radar and allow you to go and look at that on your own. I'm not going to get into too much detail on that, but how that may apply to law enforcement officers and peace officers under these new changes, you may want to take a look at that.
Okay, sexual violence protective orders. As you recall, last year they expanded our definition of cohabitant to include individuals who'd been involved in a consensual sexual relationship. Unfortunately, that didn't turn out to be quite the nightmare that perhaps we thought it was going to be. But as a result of that playing out in this past year, we've become aware that those involved in non-consensual sexual encounters, meaning rape, sexual assault, there was not a means, if they were not a cohabitant by one of the other categories, there was not a means for them to get a protective order. So House Bill 100 enacts the Sexual Violence Protection Act and creates an ex parte sexual violence protective order, which can then become a sexual violence protective order. It's laid out very similarly to our cohabitant and civil protective order statutes and language with the same provisions. This is limited. The life of a sexual violence protective order is only 1 year. It will automatically expire unless extended. It's only allowed to have one extension, and that cannot be for more than 1 year. But this does provide a much-needed protection for someone who's been the victim of a rape or sexual assault or other sexual offense. While we're talking about sexual assault, there's been a question or an issue raised in different parts of the state we wanted to provide some clarification on, and that is also associated with the cohabitant definition. Sexual assault certainly can be a domestic violence offense where it's occurring between cohabitants. As a result of that, where it's a domestic violence offense, officers are mandated under domestic violence statutes to fully investigate those without necessarily the cooperation or participation of a survivor of such an offense. The question is that when a sex assault kit is done through a forensic nurse, and it is restricted, meaning at the time of the forensic exam, it was conveyed to the nurse that the survivor did not want that information to go further with law enforcement. It doesn't happen very often, but on rare occasion, we may have a restricted kit that law enforcement takes in as a safekeep in their evidence room. However, if it's a domestic violence offense, there's been some question and discussion as to whether or not they can get into that kit for the benefit of that forensic evidence. The answer to that question is you cannot. That evidence is not accessible. Similarly to a suspect, we cannot access forensic evidence from a suspect without consent or a warrant. This is a victim, so we're not going to get a warrant, which means we would have to have consent to access that forensic evidence. And without that, we cannot access that. So it would just remain in the evidence room as safekeep while officers go and investigate the other avenues of a domestic violence case involving crime scenes and witness statements and et cetera and so forth, but they cannot access that sex assault kit without the consent of the surviving victim. Okay, House Bill 137. This deals with domestic violence enhancements. As you recall, in the past, you could only enhance a prior domestic violence conviction within a 5-year window. That now has increased to 10 years with one exception. So domestic violence offenses can be enhanced within a 10-year window now unless it is a criminal mischief offense. They have deemed property offenses to not be as severe, which is definitely not necessarily the case. But for purposes of this statute, criminal mischief can only be enhanced within a 5-year window. All other domestic violence offenses can be enhanced within a 10-year window.
House Bill 139 has to do with vehicle emissions. There are a bunch of administrative things and Department of Health and all sorts of stuff in this that doesn't really apply to us. However, there is a new traffic offense that you need to be aware of. This idea of when people are driving down the road in their diesel truck and they roll coal and they blow smoke in somebody's face as they go by. It's always been a super jerk move, but now it is illegal, and it is a traffic offense. So if a vehicle emits an excessive amount of exhaust in a manner that distracts or endangers a vulnerable user of a highway. So vulnerable user of a highway is already defined in code. That did not change. That's our pedestrians, cyclists, different people like that, that are not in motor vehicles utilizing our roadways. If there's an excessive amount of exhaust emitted, that distracts them or endangers them, then it is a traffic offense that a stop can be done and you can issue the citation for that. House Bill 149 is one that's got a lot of publicity when this came around on May 14th. And then again yesterday, it hit the news again. It's this idea of lane filtering for motorcycles. You may have seen this case yesterday, and I don't know when you'll be listening to this, so it won't be yesterday to you when you're listening to it, but it's yesterday as of today, where there was a motorcycle rider who had a helmet cam driving and recorded a situation where the pizza delivery man opened the door and stopped him and told him, you need to get in a lane, blah, 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 and we went through this. And so there's been a lot of discussion about this again as it's going through. Interestingly enough, if you watch that helmet cam video closely enough, that motorcyclist could have been given a ticket for illegal lane filtering, and I'll talk about why here in just 1 second. So we do have this ability in overtaking vehicles, and this is just added to the code of passing vehicles, okay, or overtaking other vehicles on the roadway, but it creates the option for motorcycles to lane filter. Now, let's discuss exactly what lane filtering is. Lane filtering is only legal for motorcycles. And if you're wondering what a motorcycle is, Utah code already defines a motorcycle. Go in there and look at it. If it doesn't meet that definition, then that vehicle cannot lane filter. It's only motorcycles under the code that can lane filter. And then it has to be a very specific roadway. It has to be a roadway that has two or more lanes, adjacent lanes, traveling in the same direction. And the speed limit must be 45 miles per hour or less. So it's not going to apply on our freeways ever. On and off ramps to the freeway, it doesn't apply to. So even at the metered lights on ramps, motorcycles will not be able to filter because the speed limit on an on-ramp is the same to the roadway, which our freeways are 70 or more, depending on where we're at in the state. So it's not going to apply on places like Bangor Highway or other places where the speed limit's above 45 miles per hour. So two or more adjacent lanes in the same direction and 45 miles an hour or less. And then again, it has to be a motorcycle. And these are the circumstances where it will be legal. The vehicles being overtaken must be stopped. This is where the motorcyclist in the news yesterday actually violated the law. If you see the first few vehicles that are overtaken, they are slowly moving. They are rolling, coming to a stop at the red light. The motorcycle rider jumped the gun and started filtering before those vehicles were stopped. Vehicles have to be completely stopped to be overtaken legally. That's number one. The motorcycle has to be traveling less than 15 miles per hour. And then ultimately, the move has to be able to be made safely. And so if there is a crash involved in this, that is pretty much telling you that the move was not made safely. This has caused a little bit of consternation as I've talked to some people around the state. The reality is as an officer, you have discretion. And as you go out on traffic crashes and accidents, there might be times where both parties violated a law and you cite both parties. In this situation yesterday, if that motorcycle rider would have hit the door of the person, yes, you absolutely could have cited the person for opening their door and causing that crash. However, as you go and review that video, you see that motorcycle rider illegally lane filtered. The cars were moving that were overtaken. And so it's a circumstance where maybe you could have, if you wanted to, as the officer, cite both parties. So again, it's one that is going to be highly emotional, obviously. Not one that we would have expected to be highly emotional. You never know which one of these laws are going to be really strike the chords emotionally for people around, but obviously it's been that way. It's got a lot of action on social media and the news networks yesterday, but be on the lookout for that. It's very specific what they have to do to be legal, though, and if they're not, they should be receiving citations.
House Bill 152, this is the voluntary commitment of a firearm amendment. The intent behind this is to allow a cohabitant or an owner of a gun who fears that that gun could be used as a threat to themselves or someone else to be turned into law enforcement for safekeeping. The intent is clear, and for law enforcement to receive a gun for safekeep under these circumstances, either turned in by the owner or a cohabitant, that's not a problem. However, the statute does have some conflicted language that creates some confusion as to how long and from whom can the law enforcement agency keep the gun. Some of the language makes it appear that it can be kept and then returned after 60 days. Some other language makes it appear that if the owner of the gun comes in and requests it, that it must be immediately returned to the owner. Obviously, that would undermine the protective power of this statute. If I was to come in and be fearful for my husband, either harming myself or him, and turned in his gun for safe keep, and then he came in the door 2 minutes after me and asked for his gun back, the question is whether or not law enforcement agencies can lawfully, under the statute, continue to hold that gun for safe keep. I'm not going to tell you the answer to that because I don't have that. This is a bill, House Bill 152, that your administration should take a look at and your legal counsel should take a look at to develop a policy for your agency. Again, receiving the gun for safekeep is not a problem. The question is, for how long and under what circumstances can they keep the gun if the owner requests it? So again, House Bill 152 needs some additional review.
House Bill 163 is the Offenses Against the Administration of Government Amendments, or as I have lovingly renamed, the Making All Public Employees Felons Act. I say that joking. I apologize. I know this is being recorded. As public employees, we do need to be aware of this. This is something that applies across the board to anybody who's a public employee, whether you're a law enforcement officer, a prosecutor, a judge, a legislator, a school district employee, a city parks employee, whoever you are that you work for a public entity, you are a public servant and this bill applies to you. We have always known that if you receive public money in a budget and you misappropriate that money or use it for personal expenses, that's against the law and you were going to be subject to criminal prosecution. However, this change makes public property added to that as well, not just public money. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is public property? Public property is essentially anything that we have to be able to do our job. I'm sitting at Post talking on awesome equipment right now for this webinar, and every single bit of this is public property. And I am not allowed to use that for personal use, just as a broad rule, and then we'll talk about some exceptions, obviously, as we go through. So a computer, a cell phone, a binder, a pen, any of these things that we get from our offices that are paid for with public money is considered public property. And so we have to be careful. This bill goes into effect July 1st, 2019. This is one of the delayed implementations as they wanted to give people a chance to make sure that their policies and things were up to speed and able to give people the ability and protection that they need. Your patrol car, it's public property. If you're going home from work tonight and you're off shift, you've called off, you're off, you're heading home, and you decide, you know what, I need to stop and get a gallon of milk. So you drive to the grocery store, you grab yourself a gallon of milk, and you head home. That is personal use of your patrol car of public property. So what needs to happen for you to not be a felon come July 1st for grabbing that gallon of milk? I use that example. It's an extreme example, but it's one that I think you may run into a lot more than you may realize. There are exceptions in the statute, and I'll talk about those here. Neither the public entity or nor some other law prohibits the use. Okay, that's our baseline. If the law or your agency prohibits that, then don't do it. It's not only going to get you in trouble with your policy now, but it might get you a felony on your record. As you go forward, so you have to be careful. And then the other question we have to ask is, the value provided to the public entity substantially outweigh the personal benefit received by the employee for using the public property? So does that, does you having your patrol vehicle, that public property, is the public benefit to the public entity, does that substantially outweigh that personal benefit you receive by going and getting the gallon of milk? Yeah, it would be. So now, once we've crossed that threshold and we realize we can meet those two things, there are additional things that we have to use, or that we have to do. First, the public entity authorizes the public servant to possess and use the public property for a public purpose. Okay, they can't give you a patrol car strictly for personal use, okay, or for personal purposes. The fact that you have that patrol car or that computer or whatever the public property is needs to be for a public purpose. And then the primary purpose of the possession is for use as duties as a public servant. So if you have any property that's been issued to you that you never use for your duties, but it is only for a pub or for personal use, that's the only time you ever use it, then you need to be careful. I would probably return that property to your agency or employer and not utilize that because the primary purpose of the possession needs to be for duties, not for personal use. And then at the time, the last thing that needs to be in place is at the time of the personal use. So it can't come after the fact with retroactive applicability. It has to be at the time of the personal use. The public entity has a written policy in effect that authorizes the personal use in addition to the public use. So the take home here is this is the bottom line. Your agency, whether whoever you are and whomever you work for needs to have a written policy as of July 1st that authorizes you to have personal use of the public property that's been issued to you to do your job. And it doesn't matter. Again, it applies to everything that is given to you to be able to do your job. Have that personal or have that written policy in place. Verbal policies and verbal permission from a supervisor or a chief or a director is not going to be good enough. It has to be written. You better have it for a public purpose, and the primary purpose of the possession needs to be for you to do your duties. If all those things are met, come July 1st, you can still stop on your way home from work and grab that gallon of milk if your agency allows it in written form. And for the rest of us that don't have patrol vehicles, whatever the property might be, just make sure that the written policy is there and you're using it according to the policy and you're meeting those other factors, and then we should be fine. I've actually heard from several people that they're already going to be trying to take a look at this bill to see if they can clarify it and make some changes to it next year. I don't know what the appetite for that is or what will happen, but until a change happens, we better make sure that we're following these things very closely, because you just never know how you or your name or your agency is going to get reported for something like this. And once it gets reported, if you're violating this, the ability to stop a felony from coming will be completely out of yours and your agency's control. And so just make sure you're following this. We don't want everybody to become felons come July 1st.
House Bill 192, Statute of Limitations. Another change to statute of limitations has to do with our DNA results. Previously, when DNA was collected and due to increased sizes of profiles and advanced technology and testing, we would have a hit and be able to identify a perpetrator, and then there would be a one-year statute of limitations allowed. If the statute of limitations for the initial crime had already run, there'd be a one-year extension to allow for further investigation and prosecution. That has now been stretched. Through House Bill 192, we now have 4 years. The trigger for the statute of limitations doesn't occur until the identity of the perpetrator is actually obtained. But then if a statute of limitations has run, we have 4 years to further investigate and to file for prosecution, which makes sense. In some of our older cases, it certainly is incredibly time intensive to try and go back and piece together the evidentiary foundation and basis for the case, where we're trying to locate people and track down other evidence that perhaps has been on hold or lost for 10, 20, even 30 or more years. So that's a helpful change for us as investigators and prosecutors.
House Bill 223, the unlawful installation of a tracking device. This bill creates a new Class A misdemeanor to knowingly install or direct another to install a tracking device on a vehicle that you do not own or you do not have permission to do so. There is some exceptions for private investigators that you'll want to take a look at and see how that may apply to you. But otherwise, just straight up Class A misdemeanor to knowingly install a tracking device on a vehicle that you don't own or that you don't have permission to be able to put that tracking device on.
House Bill 243, Domestic Violence Modifications. This bill is very well intended, but could have some high risk possible outcomes. So be aware of this. This bill's intent is to provide additional protection to domestic violence victims by allowing, once they receive a domestic violence or a dating violence protective order, it allows them to carry a concealed firearm without a permit for 120 days. During that time, because of the statute, they cannot be charged with carrying a loaded firearm in a vehicle or on a street or for carrying a concealed firearm. The harm or the risk of this is, as law enforcement officers, as you go out on these domestic violence calls, you may now be dealing with someone with a firearm that you wouldn't otherwise have expected to have one. And even more concerning is the risk to a victim who chooses to carry a firearm when they do not have the skills, the training, or the comfort level with the gun to be able to use it effectively when they're under stress and not have it actually be used against them. So, again, very well intended, but something of concern to many in how this might actually play out as an increased risk factor to victims of domestic violence and certainly to law enforcement. This bill, regardless of whether or not there's a protective order in place, only applies to those who can lawfully carry a gun to begin with. So it does not provide the ability to carry a gun to someone who is otherwise a restricted person. They have to lawfully be able to carry the gun.
House Bill 251, Drug Diversion Reporting Requirements. Drug diverting is when somebody like a doctor, nurse, pharmacist, pharmacy tech has access to medicine, pills, and is diverting them for unlawful purposes to people who they shouldn't be doing it. That is still against the law, thankfully, and has not changed. There's nothing in regards to how we're going to investigate and prosecute those. There is, however, a new reporting requirement. So people that are around those doctors, those pharmacists, or whoever, those nurses, that coworkers that might know that the diverting is going on, they now have a duty to report that to law enforcement. And if they don't, it is a Class B misdemeanor. Now, there are specific amounts and types of drugs that have to be involved here for the Class B misdemeanor for failing to report to kick in. So if you have a case that you're investigating on that, make sure you take a close look at those and make sure that they meet the specific amounts and the types of drugs. But now there is that reporting requirement for those who may know that this is taking place. House Bill 258 has to deal with sexual-oriented business licenses. If you are in a municipality that requires a sexually-oriented business license to conduct whatever the business that is going on, and a person fails to obtain or is operating without that sexual-oriented business license, the simple failure to obtain that business license is now a Class A misdemeanor under state code. This only applies to cities and municipalities, however. It doesn't apply to counties. It also does not apply to people who are under the age of 17. And if prostitution has to do with this, if it's whatever the business license is, and we're talking about prostitution, under 7610.1302, you cannot do both prostitution and the Class A for the sexual-oriented business license violation. You have to pick one or the other. But now we have that Class A misdemeanor for that license violation.
A couple sex offense bills, House Bill 270 Criminal Code Amendments, and then House Bill 287 Sex Offense Amendments. With House Bill 270, this bill does three things. First of all, it adds a number of sex offenses to the list of crimes where touching includes through the clothing, on top of the clothing. For example, sex abuse of a minor involving intercourse, forcible sex abuse. These now include touching through the clothing, and there are a variety of other offenses. So it's a lengthy list. Take a look at that if you handle those cases. It also looked at the definition of indecent liberties. That definition has been expanded, so it no longer only includes touching specific parts of the actor's body or the perpetrator's body, but it also now includes when the perpetrator touches those parts of the victim's body. So that was an oversight when they made changes last year to the definition of indecent liberties that they've now come back and corrected. And the third thing is it took a look at the intent element for the offense of distribution of an intimate image. That's now changed. Rather than needing evidence of intent to cause emotional distress or harm, it is now enough to have evidence that the perpetrator knew or should have known that the distribution would cause a reasonable person to suffer emotional distress or harm. And then House Bill 287 looks at the definition of position of special trust. Increasingly so, we have young teenagers who are graduating from high school early or involved in concurrent enrollment classes on college and university campuses. So this bill expands the definition of position of special trust to include an instructor, professor, or teaching assistant at a public or private institution of higher education. That was not previously included. We, of course, know that, you know, parents are in a position of special trust. Teachers through elementary K through 12 were in that position, but now we have expanded it to include higher education. This will change or will impact our child sex offenses in a couple of ways. First of all, aggravated sex abuse of a child, which is charged if in conjunction with sex abuse of a child as an aggravating factor exists. So it now includes the abuser being in a position of trust as an aggravating factor. It also impacts our consent statute. These offenses involving anyone under the age of 18 with an instructor, professor, or teaching assistant at a higher education institution, whether it's public or private, consent cannot be given. So an instructor or professor cannot be involved in any sexual encounter with a 17-year-old, for example. Consent cannot be given, and that would be investigated as a crime. So this was done to try and protect our, you know, our kids who are certainly, you know, growing up and able to pursue education on these other campuses, but they're still kids and they're vulnerable and at higher risk of being exploited and abused by other adults.
House Bill 298 has to do with offender registry amendments. This bill has several changes for people that are on the sex offender registry and how it works with their driver license, and I'm not going to detail all that here today for you. The big change that you want to be aware of when it comes to this bill, however, has to do with child pornography. When this idea first came up, we have various places in our code where the distribution of something, like a controlled substance, is penalized at a higher level than the simple possession of it. And we had a legislator who thought that that ought to apply to child pornography as well. There was an idea to maybe reduce the simple possession of child pornography to a third-degree felony, since everything with child pornography was a second-degree felony, whether it was manufacturing, possessing, distributing, whatever it might have been. That didn't go over very well. So now, instead of reducing the possession of child pornography to a third-degree felony, the producing certain types of child pornography is now a first-degree felony. So if you are in a child pornography sting or investigation or case or anything that's going on with that, you'll want to look to see if that new first-degree felony applies to your case and that you can utilize. House Bill 313, hit-and-run amendments. This is pretty simple. Our hit-and-run statute had been amended a couple times over the last few years, and just the level of what the crime was. Now our regular run-of-the-mill hit-and-run, you back into somebody in a parking lot and bolt without following whatever duties are there, they're all Class B misdemeanors again. So they had been reduced previously to Class C, and then we had kind of a change where some were Bs and some were Cs. This year, the C language has all been the Class C misdemeanor language has all been removed, and they're all Class B misdemeanors again now as our baseline. House Bill 324, the tobacco age amendments. The age to purchase and possess tobacco is going up in the state of Utah. July 1st, 2020, that will go to 20, and July 1st, 2021, it will go to 21. So 20 and 20, 21 and 21, with one exception. If you are on active duty in the armed forces, or if you are the spouse or dependent of somebody who's on active duty in the armed forces, you can still purchase and possess tobacco in the state of Utah at the age of 18. I don't know why that is the case. I don't know why the exception, but it is there. So good luck figuring out if somebody's a dependent. I don't know what identification you have to say that I'm an 18-year-old dependent of somebody on active duty in the armed forces, but the tobacco age is raising for almost everybody.
Apparently, we don't care if our military dies from lung cancer. That's not reassuring. Okay, House Bill 325. This is an information gathering bill. Currently, when a restricted person goes in and attempts to purchase a firearm, BCI is statutorily required to notify the law enforcement agency where the person lives. This bill now directs that law enforcement agency, once notified, to provide an annual report to BCI. In that report, they have to address the number of cases that involve that person that was restricted because of domestic violence, and of those, the number of investigations and how many of those resulted in criminal charges. Once BCI receives that information, they will then compile one report for the Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Interim Committee. So that's why they are reaching out, trying to gather this information. I'm not quite sure what the end goal or concern is. I guess that remains to be seen. But until then, this will impact your admin and your clerical support in having to provide that information back to BCI. House Bill 396. Currently, lewdness involving a child includes an act committed to or in the presence of the child. This bill removes the "to" verbiage and now only requires that the act be committed in the presence of the child. And then it further expands the definition of presence to include within visual contact through an electronic device. We, increasingly are dealing with digital devices, electronic devices, and access and images through those devices. And so now presence of a child can include through an electronic device.
House Bill 410, Drug Paraphernalia Penalty Amendments. In JRI, when we reduced a lot of our drug possession of drug offenses to misdemeanors rather than felonies, we also made some changes throughout that process to drug-free zones and what applied, how wide the drug-free zones were, and what laws or statutes applied to that. We pulled the simple possession of a controlled substance out of that enhanceable offense for a drug-free zone. However, they left the possession of drug paraphernalia in. So if I was in a school and I had meth in one pocket and a meth pipe in the other, you would not have been able to enhance in a drug-free zone for the meth, but you would have been able to for the pipe. That is now no longer the case. Drug paraphernalia has been pulled out from that. So when we're talking about drug-free zones, the only offenses that are now able to be enhanced as being committed in a drug-free zone are the distribution charges. So just be aware of that as you deal with drug-free zones and possession cases.
House Bill 430 deals with female genital mutilation. We were at a conference and had a room of some 300 prosecutors, and I asked if anyone had seen a case involving this come forward, and no one raised their hand. And certainly it's a problem where it's being seen somewhere, that this bill now defines what it is and makes performing or facilitating female genital mutilation a second-degree felony. So I certainly could not perform it, nor could I provide my child to have it be performed on them, nor could any medical professional perform the act without facing criminal sanctions. And somewhat uniquely, usually we are very cautious around religious and custom and traditions. But in this case, religion and custom are not exceptions. So regardless of religious belief or practice or custom belief or practice, it is still a second-degree felony here in Utah. The only exceptions are if it is medically necessary for the health of the patient or if it is part of a sex reassignment surgery as requested by the patient. There will be a new public education campaign about the health risks and emotional trauma of FGM. So we'll probably see more on that. And certainly as our populated areas become more diverse, we just want to make sure that all those that are here are safe and protected from this harmful practice. Senate Bill 45, Domestic Violence Revisions. As you know, we have a pretty good list of criminal charges that you can add domestic violence enhancement to, meaning assault domestic violence or criminal mischief domestic violence and so forth. This bill now adds aggravated cruelty to an animal if it's committed with the intent to harass or threaten another cohabitant, which we know perpetrators often will use children or animals, pets, to punish and to torment their victim. So if that is the case in your fact scenario, they could be charged with aggravated cruelty to an animal. Now, this is not cruelty to an animal. It's aggravated cruelty to an animal. So that would include torture, poisoning or killing of the animal or causing that to occur. But if so, then you could add it as a domestic violence moniker. But just a reminder, that statute that lays out that list also has some additional verbiage that involves other violent acts. And so even though a crime may not be on that list, you could still potentially charge it as a domestic violence offense if it involves the violence described in that statute. So don't get too restricted to the list. Be open-minded, especially in cases of domestic violence, and take a look at that statute to see if whether or not you could add the domestic violence enhancement to it.
Senate Bill 58 is the Kratom Consumer Protection Act. You may or may not be familiar with Kratom. Kratom is derived from a plant that is indigenous to Southeast Asia, which has been used for centuries for medicinal purposes. What is often the case with plants that are used for medicinal purposes, they are also used to get people really stoned. And so kratom is a substance that is very impairing and can get you stoned. However, in the United States of America, there is no regulation on kratom whatsoever. So while in Malaysia, you may not be able to, where the plant actually is indigenous to and grows, you may not be able to harvest it or do anything with it whatsoever. Here in the United States, you can buy it, use it, do whatever you kind of want with it at this moment, because it is not currently scheduled on the controlled substance list by the FDA and the DEA. Kratom can be very dangerous in a lot of different areas. It is impairing. People who take it and then drive are impaired. It can have lots of other things involved with it. We have seen even some limited cases of overdose on kratom throughout the United States. It is something that is often used in supplements. Smoke shops will sell kratom in powder and supplement form and all sorts of things. This new law in Utah does about what we can to the extent to dealing with kratom until the federal government actually schedules it and puts it on the controlled substance schedule. We have two new Class C misdemeanors. The first is this new bill creates a purity guideline for what the kratom has to be. A lot of times they're adding heavy metals and other things into the kratom to make their supply go further, to be able to sell more of it. If it doesn't meet the purity level, we can charge those selling the kratom with a Class C misdemeanor. Now, I don't anticipate you sending off the kratom to be tested and analyzed by a lab and bringing in all those people for your jury trial on a Class C misdemeanor. I just don't think this is going to happen. The other, maybe we'll see a little bit more. We are not able to sell any kratom product to somebody under the age of 18 in the state of Utah anymore. And so if we have somebody that goes into a smoke shop or a supplement shop or whatever, and they're 17 or 16 and they buy kratom, we can charge those people selling just like we do through our Cubs program when we send in people underage to buy alcohol on undercover or whatever. There is the opportunity to do that with kratom products now as well. It is illegal to sell under that. And again, it's only a Class C misdemeanor. It's about all that we can do until, again, the substance gets scheduled. But be aware that kratom does have a little bit of restriction in the state of Utah now.
Senate Bill 59 is a child welfare worker protection bill. I was doing this legislative update in one of the other counties here in the state, and an officer in the back said that was my case. So the background for this bill is that the officer was assisting a child welfare worker, as many of you do, to go out to a home to perform some kind of an intervention or home removal or child removal from the home, and the parent kicked the child welfare worker. So the parent was charged with assault, and I'm sure the officer was standing there thinking, wow, right in front of me, that's fantastic. But he charged the not the child welfare worker, but the parent with assault. And there was somewhat of an outcry in that community. It's a smaller community that there should be additional protection. So Senate Bill 59 creates a separate crime for assaulting or threatening violence against a child welfare worker. In order to be charged with that crime, the defendant has to do a couple things. First of all, they have to know that the person they're assaulting is, in fact, a child welfare worker. And second, that the victim must be acting within the scope of his or her authority at the time that the assault or threat of violence occurs. So if I'm at the grocery store and someone comes up and assaults me and they do not know that I'm a child welfare worker, they could not be charged with this offense. Similarly, if they do know that I'm a child welfare worker, but I'm at the grocery store and I'm simply buying vegetables and not acting within the scope of my authority at the time, then they could not be charged with it. Hopefully, as we progress, we can expand that, because we can certainly see situations where someone is revengeful and sees a child welfare worker who maybe has taken some action involving their family in some other context and lash out at them. But for now, it has to be within those two requirements. This offense is a Class A misdemeanor unless the defendant acts intentionally or knowingly and causes substantial bodily injury. If there is such injury, then it would be a third-degree felony.
Senate Bill 68 has to do with driver license and DUIs. Very simple change in regards to what we're talking about here. When you make a DUI arrest, you no longer have to physically take the driver license from that person and issue them a temporary license. Their own driver license will serve as their temporary license as we go through that. There's some questions in regards to the time for. We've had several questions that come up as we've been going around talking about this bill on the hearings and the time for the hearings. It doesn't impact law enforcement officers whatsoever. Your situation will be the same. It's simply the notice requirement for DLD. So just want to make that clear. The timeline for the hearing did not change for you. But again, don't take the driver license anymore when you make a DUI arrest. You should have received new citations and updated forms from DLD that you were able to put into your Spillman or whatever other service you use for your report writing and citations and whatnot. And if you haven't got that, you'll want to make sure you reach out to DLD and get that done very quickly and get that stuff uploaded. But no longer take the license, but still issue the citation or arrest or book or however you're going to do that.
Senate Bill 103, Victim Targeting Penalty Enhancements. This has to do with what we refer to as our hate crimes. In this bill, the severity or the consequences for a hate crime is increased. For example, misdemeanors are now increased by one level as far as charging. So if it would normally have been a Class B, if it is a hate crime, it could be shown that the victim was targeted because of that personal attribute, then it could be enhanced to the next level. If it's a third or a second degree felony, and it's punishable by a prison sentence, this does not mandate that prison be imposed, but if prison is imposed, there would be a minimum of 1 to 5 to be served on a third degree felony and or 2 to 15 on a second degree felony. If it's a first degree felony, this is now an aggravating factor that the judge will consider at sentencing. So the personal attributes recognized by Utah includes 18 different characteristics, including age, ancestry, disability, ethnicity, familial status, gender identity, homelessness, marital status, matriculation, meaning rivalry between education institutions, BYU versus Utes, for example, national origin, political expression, race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, service in the armed forces, status as an emergency responder, or status as a peace officer. And if the victim falls within maybe multiple of those, perhaps they are a female peace officer who is divorced, then they would not be able to enhance it 3 times. There's only one enhancement. You cannot stack the enhancements, but it could be elevated by one level if a misdemeanor and have the minimum prison if a third degree or second degree felony, or be considered as an aggravating factor if a first degree felony.
Senate Bill 270 is vandalism on public lands. This is a bill that is in addition to our regular criminal mischief or graffiti statute. Anybody who graffitis or vandalizes any public land, whether it's state or federally owned public land, or a permanent fixture on those public lands, can now be guilty of this separate offense. There are some specific sentencing requirements for courts if somebody is found guilty under this statute or convicted under this statute. So be aware that it is there in addition to our graffiti and or criminal mischief statutes. That is the last bill that we're going to talk about here. As you all aware, we had the Utah Medical Cannabis Act pass a ballot initiative last year, and then the governor called a special session where the legislature modified that. If you are interested in having a discussion about the Utah Medical Cannabis Act, the changes that are on board, things that have happened, please reach out to me. You can get my information through our website, upc.utah.gov. Feel free to get on there. My email and phone number are there and available there. Reach out to me. I'm happy to come and do a training specifically on that. We're not covering that here today just because it is an expansive topic and one that Marlise doesn't want to sit and listen to me talk for 45 minutes while I go through that one piece of legislation. And so we're just making it available. I do have a training on that, on cannabis and the update on that in regards to other things with cannabis as well, that I'd be happy to come to your departments and train you on and talk about and discuss and answer any questions that you might have. Just reach out to me. You can get my email and phone number off the website, and you can grab it there. Any other training that needs that you have in regards to the impaired driving world, I would be more than happy to come and help you with. Just please get a hold of me and Marlise. I'll let her talk about hers as well.
As the sexual assault and domestic violence resource prosecutor, I too have some training that I'm happy to provide to you as law enforcement. Our role as resource prosecutors is really to provide support, to provide information support, to help you be able to do your job in the way that you need to and want to, and yet perhaps don't have time or access to other information. As you may recall, HB 200 from 2 years ago mandated us in conjunction with POST to offer a first responders to sex assault cases training, which I am out and about the state doing. That's a 2-hour curriculum. If I've not been to your police agency, please pass my information on to your training coordinator, as I'm happy to come out. We can accommodate multiple shifts, you know, attend several times so that you can rotate people through to get that training out to your first responding officers. But in addition, any other sexual assault or domestic violence issues, I have a multiple different trainings that I'm happy to come and provide to provide that additional support and information to you and to your department. And I think that's about all we have. So I hope this has been helpful, and just stay safe out there.
Thank you. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Tyson and Marlise with Utah Prosecution Counsel, for this presentation. On behalf of the Utah Prosecution Counsel, Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training, thank you for listening in today. If you would like more information on previous and upcoming training events, we invite you to log in to the ACADIS training portal and search under the registration tab.